one of the significant moves that the president did make that's substantive related to Asia is, doing away with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Do you want to weigh in, Jane Wales, on what the impact of that is?
Yeah, no, it's very serious. Well, first, I'd say that, I think what we do know about Donald Trump is he would like us to take us out of the business of rulemaking for the world, for, building and sustaining, protecting an international order that's in our interests, but we believe in the interests of global stability. So each of the elements of rulemaking are being sort of taken down, and this is one of the few places where I see some consistency. The TPP is a big piece of that. I mean, international trade is a big piece of the new order. When I say new, I mean post-World War II order. The very new order is to pull away from those kinds of regimes. I think the area, I'll give an example that's sort of less obvious, but that Gloria and I spent big parts of our lives thinking about, is even the non-proliferation regime, nuclear non-proliferation regime, which is always, we've always understood to be in our interest. But Gloria will add to this, I'm sure. I mean, during the campaign, when President Trump said that South Korea and Japan should increase their own contribution to their own security, he also said, and they should consider whether or not to get nuclear weapons. And this was the man who'd also said, you have nuclear weapons in order to use them. So that was extremely alarming for the region, but alarming way beyond the region. Because it's a sort of stepping away from a rules-based system that we've always in the past seen as being in our interest. You can imagine how rattling that could be.
Well, Gloria Duffy, let's talk about North Korea a little bit, just because they yesterday lobbed four missiles in waters near Japan. So they are the latest in terms of news and in terms of aggression. And you've talked about Trump's confrontational style. You've even called it a bomb thrower style, for lack of a better description. But I'm wondering, how it helps or hurts in terms of dealing with a regime like North Korea.
So bomb throwing on a verbal level is not necessarily a bad thing. It can create unpredictability, such as when you throw a bomb, like we're going to abandon the One China policy, and then you throw the bomb again, that you're not going to do that. It can make people wonder about your stability and credibility. Shaking things up is not necessarily a bad thing, though. And we've had some leaders who have shaken things up in a good way and so on. When it comes to North Korea and so many other areas, though, you have to look at what's the policy below that or beyond that. Is there really a different policy that can be effective? Right now, I don't see a different policy on North Korea. There were some anti-ballistic missile defenses deployed to South Korea, but that's something that's sort of been in U.S. policy and plans for a long time. So we have the North Korea problem. I don't see that we have a new solution to the North Korea problem. The question is, does the destabilization of relations with China and so on negatively impact the ability to have influence on North Korea, because we've depended on the Chinese to be helpful in that way? So again, we always have to look below this rhetorical level to whether there's something new and promising. And so far, I don't see it on North Korea.
Do you want to add anything about North Korea, Jane Wales, specifically in terms of this recent provocation?
Sure. I mean, as you think about the option, I mean, I think sort of rule number one, as Gloria pointed out, is you need your friends, right, in order to deal with a problem that complex. We need Japan. We need South Korea. We need China in particular. But we need all three to be along with us. And so shaking up those relationships can reduce our options. And sort of rule number two is never reduce your options, right? You always want to expand them if you can. If you think about them for North Korea, for this situation, there's negotiating. He says he's a deal maker. This is a great opportunity to test that proposition. It may not come to us to a resolution, but it certainly buys a little bit of time, and it may give us the time to build a consensus with our friends and allies in the region as to what approach to take. The other kinds of, I mean, New York Times reported pretty extensively on the kinds of proposals that are going before the president right now.
And particular they, cyber warfare.
Well, and they include, though, a attack on the missile sites. And the problem with that is that we won't necessarily get them all. And that's an act of war. And so you may provoke the very attack you're trying to thwart. You know, the second that I understand is going before him is the reintroduction of short-range nuclear weapons in South Korea, bringing back and there you're kind of counting on Kim having a rational response to that. You're counting on him being willing to back down. That's not something he's ever been a fan of, and I'm sure Donald Trump is also not a fan of backing down.
And some have pointed to the recent death of his half-brother as another sign of how erratic Kim Jong-un can be.
Exactly. And then finally, cyber attacks. And that's been President Obama's preferred approach. And the one worry I have about that, I mean, what we've seen over the years, past 3 years, is a lot of missile tests going awry as a result of cyber and electronic attacks. And there are a lot of reasons that that's an appealing approach. You just slow down the progress of the North when it comes to ICB, intercontinental ballistic missiles. But here's the problem. Once you open up a world in which it's okay to use cyber attacks to disable nuclear controls, you've opened up the whole question of how deterrence works, right? And if we can do it, the Chinese can do it, and the Chinese can do it, the Russians could do it, et cetera. If you don't establish the norms now, and you just back yourself into a really chaotic and highly dangerous regime, I guess all I'd say is that's a choice I wouldn't want to be backed into. I'd like to know that my government had thought through the implications. So that's all to say we don't have great options.
Yes, I think that's how the North Korean situation has almost always been described, yeah. Right? It's just a series of bad options, yeah. Essentially. But who, if any, would you say is driving the president's Asia policy, Asia-Pacific policy, if you could point to anybody, the administration?
Well, I think it remains to be seen. You've got, a couple of known players in place with Secretary Mattis at Defense and with Tillerson at State.
And they've certainly been ensuring, our allies, Japan and South
there,
Korea.
There is now a senior Asia person at the NSC, Matt Ottinger, who is knowledgeable expert on Asian affairs and former journalist with Wall Street Journal and a former Marine, spent time in Afghanistan and, is, I think, a known quantity in the Asia watching community. So, I think it is still, as all of us who have been observing this would conclude, it's very much a work in progress in terms of fleshing out and filling out both the staffing as well as articulating policy. At this point, all we have are bits and pieces from various confirmation hearings and not much other than trying to connect various tweets to figure out what the overall, coherent framework is for foreign policy toward the region.
Well, Bruce Pickering, do you want to add to this in terms of what Trump's initial statements or tweets and initial appointments signify for the road forward?
I think the great thing about this conversation, if you were talking about Obama, the bandwidth would be about here. You'd know that, one possibility, this possibility, they aren't too far apart. We all could predict. I think what you get with Donald Trump is something completely unpredictable. So the only predictability is that whatever comes is not going to be something that any of us, I think, could predict. I mean, it's a band. I will say that, to me, I really wonder, I think to me the critical question that I really wonder about, and this comes from my background as an historian, but I do wonder about the stability over the long term of American policy, because I don't think my guess is that none of these people really understand the history much, which is that
He's the only people in his administration.
None of them. I mean, maybe Tillerson, maybe Mattis a bit. But, you know, basically the world after 1919 was pretty horrible. And there was a realization, even in the midst of World War II, that when it looked obvious that Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan would be defeated, there was an awareness that if you went back and tried to revisit the same punitive terms that you got in Paris in 1919, you'd be back at it again with far more destructive weapons. And so what resulted of this was really basically a group of far-sighted American decision makers led by Franklin Roosevelt, strongly supported by the British and Prime Minister Winston Churchill, who said, okay, we need to create a new world, one that does not build on national rivalries so much as creates, encases them in a kind of web of international institutions. So out of that, you got the United Nations, you got NATO, you got the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, the World Bank, Bretton Woods. All these things were designed to create a world in which Japan, Germany could come back into the family of nations to create a basic international order that was predictable and basically did contain the Soviet Union, then Soviet Union, but basically created a world order that was stable and would not allow these kind of national tensions to give rise to fascism, Nazism, authoritarianism, all the things that came out of World War I. I mean, that's the real critical turning point. And so what I'm worried about here is that this disruption throws out all this stability. And, as expensive as it may be to maintain a set of alliances abroad, I'm pretty sure it's going to be more expensive to fight a series of wars all over the world or try and contain them once they get started. So if we really want to let that go, we can do it. And the United States still remains the indispensable nation at the core of it. But it's a really dangerous option. And if you learned anything from 9/11, it's that the world will come to you if you are not out in the world.
We haven't talked yet about China, and I think we really have to. And Gloria Duffy, you alluded to China as being such an important player in any containment of North Korea. But could we back up a little bit? And I'd like to get your impression of what you think the Trump administration's approach is to dealing with China.
Me?
Gloria Duffy. Yes.
A little hard to tell at this point. The America First theme of this administration is being strongly applied to China, making sure that the economics and security relationship with China is very protective of the U.S. and U.S. interests. But I find it hard to discern any stable theme beyond that. So perhaps we better turn to the deeper Asia experts here.
Well, it feels like David. In some ways, David Arnold, that China is being cast more as a villain right now, right? That the U.S. has suffered at the hands financially in terms of it hasn't gotten, its end of the deal, basically, right? It feels like that's been at least the tough talk. And then, of course, there was that whole kerfuffle around the One China policy, which appears to have been relatively smoothed out, right? But at the same time, you know, he seems to be influenced by Navarro, for example, who's a sharp China critic. So if you had to say what, you know, the administration's approach is to this world power, and also maybe even how China sees what the U.S. is doing. Does China see the U.S. In a position of retreat right now in terms of Asia? Does it, and how does that influence our relationship with that nation?
I think you've got about five questions embedded in that.
I have,
but let me just
But it
start.
Just sort of underscores just how complex that relationship is.
I think the great risk, frankly, of a retreat from a U.S. leadership role, and this is something that came out very clearly in the seminars and the outreach that we had around our report on America's role in Asia, is there's a great desire on the part of other countries in Asia for the U.S. to maintain a position of strong leadership and engaged participation economically on security-related matters and on soft power relationships. Yes, it's a hedging strategy for many of them. They want to maintain the economic ties and benefits of working with China. They want to maintain the security umbrella of the U.S. They don't want to be forced into a situation of having to choose between the U.S. and China. And I think if you ask them how they would like to see that relationship, it's kind of the Goldilocks approach, not too hot and not too cold. And I think that's kind of the consensus from, thoughtful, experienced foreign policy observers across the region. I think China is actually quite pleased that the Trump administration has pulled out of TPP. Xi Jinping goes to Davos and is the champion of globalization. That we're talking about not fulfilling obligations of the Paris Climate Accord. Xi Jinping is going to, make sure that, all those commitments are upheld. So I think there's, to the extent that by pulling back, we create an opening and an opportunity, China is more than willing to fill that void in that vacuum, and we've seen it in a variety of areas. So I think there, in addition to, I think, Bruce's excellent points about the strong U.S. interest in kind of maintaining a commitment to this global, international, rules-based order, the reality is the more we turn inward, the more China is going to become the dominant power and the dominant player in Asia.
And can you talk about what you see as the impacts of that?
Well, I think there are multiple dimensions to Chinese role and influence in terms of economic power, political influences, and the security issues that that it poses for other countries in neighbors in the region. You have long historical animosities in a number of instances. You have countries that have fought wars with China. So there is a strong interest in not being subject to China as a regional hegemon, much less a global hegemon.
Jane Wells, did you want to add anything to that?
Well, I guess I say the other place where we appear to be ceding a leadership role is in economic development. Particularly in Africa, but beyond. And there, I mean, if we have the kind of cuts in State Department and USAID that are being projected in order to help finance the increases in Pentagon spending, you really do see the world of economic development to the Chinese. You know, in Bruce's analysis, he pointed out that one of the two of the Bretton Woods institutions were the World Bank and the IMF. And it really was, that was when the concept of economic development was born.
Absolutely.
Right? During at that moment in history with Acheson and McCloy and Kennan and these great minds that were there then. And it's been, it's been an American consensus that this is part of, that this is core to our interests, is to help other countries prosper and help ultimately give rise to more democratic states, was the concept. And it's been a bipartisan consensus as recently as last year, support for economic development around the world. It is something that, for example, General Mattis is extremely supportive of, feels that it's central to our security and stability that we do that. Now, the one thing to think about is also not just the impact on our sort of ceding an important role, but also the impact on Africa. Because the way our aid budget works is we give to the social sector through governments, through the host governments. We hire locals to do the work, or locals are hired by the social sector actors. The way the Chinese do it is that the money goes to a state-owned enterprise, a Chinese state-owned enterprise, and they hire Chinese to go and build roads and bridges, et cetera. So it's a very different development impact. Those two different approaches. So that's another area I'd add to David's list of where we're ceding seating a leadership role.
Are there things that non-governmental organizations, nonprofit organizations, things that they can do to help shape the relationship, right, despite whatever national policy may emerge from this? Gloria Duffy, do you want to talk about that a little
bit? Well, we have a rich fabric of relationships with Asia through the nonprofit sector. One thing that's of concern is to the extent that some of those institutions are hybrid between government and the private sector, the announced cutbacks or projected cutbacks in funding through the State Department or other parts of the U.S. government may have a significant impact. For instance, the East-West Center in Honolulu, a longstanding connective organization between the U.S. and Asia, is slated for, I believe, termination of its funding from the U.S. government is what I'm hearing, and perhaps the Asia Foundation may have some impact as well. So that's something that may damage the fabric of institutions. On the other hand, we have many organizations that are nonprofits that are active in Asia. They work in the areas of development. They work in the areas of environment and conservation. They work in the areas of stimulating philanthropy. They work in even some of the tech companies have programs of assistance, as they do in this country, in Asia. So that's something that's going to need the attention of the private sector and the public to strengthen those nonprofit organizations.
Bruce Pickering, do you want to add at all to, you know, this conversation about what the West Coast can do to help Asia tackle sort of non-traditional or soft power challenges, right?
Yeah, I think a couple things. One is that when the federal government cedes a tremendous amount of its kind of authority, I suppose, for want of a better word, it creates a vacuum in the state of California, but also in the entire West Coast. I think Washington, Oregon, as well as California, they can either assume a leadership position or not. And clearly this state, and I think Washington, Oregon, have said, yes, you know, this is something, we have something to contribute. We, I think, have a series of, you know, one of the things that's fascinating to me is if you look at California, to some degree, I just put it out there, it's kind of a Republican nightmare if you think about it, because it's a state that has high taxes, at least relatively speaking to the rest of the country. It's highly regulated. And yet, it's doing very, very well. I mean, the state is, you know, the problem we have, if you go to somebody in the Bay Area and say, what's your problem? The problem is housing. Why is the problem of housing? Because we got beyond full employment at this point. I mean, we have so many jobs that you know, it's really hard for businesses to even find, you know, workers. And so what's interesting to me in this is I think the subnational organizations, Commonwealth Club, Asia Society, World Affairs, Asia Foundation, we are kind of the bridges that the U.S. government probably should have but maybe doesn't have now. And so the states and subnational organizations like ours are the ones that are probably going to be in a leadership role until the federal government figures out, which I think will eventually happen, that it needs to be more engaged. But at this point, it puts more of a burden but also gives more of an opportunity to state and NGO organizations, I think.
Jane Wells, can you speak to this from the perspective of the philanthropy community or the Silicon Valley companies?
I mean, both. So what's interesting is that you put those two together, and that's a very California thing as well. It really is. That sort of, you know, not only are we kind of borderless when it comes to countries, but we're borderless when it comes to sectors, right? And that companies expect to play a role that has to do with the, you know, the public good, as well as making sure the business makes money, and so it's been interesting for us. Of course, we're host of something called the Global Philanthropy Forum here, and just about everybody in Silicon Valley has embraced philanthropy in one way or another, and the vast majority of them have global portfolios. They do global giving. They also do local giving, but they do have this kind of sense of engagement with the rest of the world. And the range of it, I mean, I guess I'd say sort of the overarching issue for them is inequality, inequality at home, which is something that played a big role in the elections, but also inequality abroad. China has got a real challenge there. And so most of their giving is in the sort of space of economic development, poverty alleviation, et cetera. And you find that they bring their companies into the same set of issues.
David Arnold, I would like you to talk about why NGOs and nonprofit organizations like yours are so crucial to, you know, the shaping the Asia-U.S. relationship.
Well, I think all of our institutions play kind of a crucial bridging role. The fact that we operate in 18 countries across Asia and that we've been in many of these countries for decades means that, that kind of depth of engagement, commitment, serves as a ballast in these turbulent times as questions about what the high-level foreign policy is going to be are subject to debate and speculation. The fact that there are American institutions, nonprofit organizations, and for-profit and philanthropic institutions that have staying power and that have a longer-term vision in terms of how to assist in helping to create a more peaceful, prosperous Asia-Pacific region, I think it matters a lot. If I can put in a plug, I think it's very worthy of support from people that are like-minded and see the value and importance of these bridging institutions to sustain the U.S.-Asia ties and relationships as there are big debates about what direction U.S. Foreign policy may take.
You were, as you mentioned earlier, in Asia, not that long ago and talking with thought leaders in multiple countries. Are you seeing any effects in terms of civil society or reactions to the unpredictability or volatility of the Trump administration? I'm thinking actually along the lines of activists or, political dissidents in some of the countries where you were.
In each of the countries, there is a range of political views and ideologies that are represented. And I think in general, Asians are taking a wait-and-see approach to the Trump administration. In some countries, I think there's actually admiration for Trump as a strong leader, as someone that's going to be firm and decisive, and so on and so forth. In other parts of the same societies, you will see people that are deeply worried about will the U.S. continue to stand up for human rights? Will it continue to project values as part of its foreign policy, or will we only be interested in interests as the main driver for U.S. foreign policy? But I think in general there is a sense of the jury being out and Trump neutrality in many of the places that we work.
Do you see, Jane Wales, any chilling effect on activism if the U.S. sort of abdicates its role as some kind of a moral leader or within, in terms of its own values and projecting those values on Asia?
Probably the opposite. I mean, probably what you're seeing is a realization of how important people-to-people work is and how important the grassroots efforts are and how important it is to not have a closing of civil society but an opening of civil society throughout Asia as well. So no, I don't see a shrinking back. I think I sort of see a doubling down, if anything. I think on this question of they're trying to figure out whether we'll be only interest-based and not values-based, I think they also have to be trying to figure out how Donald Trump defines our interests.
Yes. Yes. Any thoughts?
I mean, it might be quite different. I mean, I don't know that it is America first to pull out of TPP, for example. I mean, I think there are a lot of choices being made that don't clearly align with this concept of America First. So I think we're all kind of guessing at that.
Gloria Duffy, how effective can California be in influencing the national narratives around America's relationship with Asia? I mean, do you think California can go it alone if it has to, and how?
Well, we've got our own attorney general, so to speak, and Eric Holder, who's going to try to help us do that. California is the sixth largest economy in the world. We already have a governor who has, and our prior governor, Governor Schwarzenegger, lined out a strategy, really, where on climate change, the U.S. essentially was going to devise policies and implement them on our own, no matter what the federal government did. So this was clear at the Paris Climate Summit. It's been clear for a while that the U.S., that California, in terms of our own regulation, in terms of using whatever influence we have with other countries and in the United States, is going to have a policy to reduce our carbon footprint and to adhere to global climate change norms. So that's already happening. So I think, yes, in a number of areas, California can go its own way and be influential throughout the region.
We've been collecting some of your questions, and I'd like to incorporate them into the conversation and encourage you to please feel free to fill out these question cards. I think Professor Maria Ortuoste, if I'm pronouncing her name correctly, may have been on the same wavelength. Her question is, the West Coast undoubtedly can provide unique and significant contributions to Asia policy, but how best can we, the West Coast, influence that policy when Trump clearly has strong, albeit changeable, opinions, and when Trump is unhappy with, say, quote, sanctuary cities? If Bruce Pickering, if anyone on the panel would like to add to this question of really the extent of West Coast influence and how it can be exercised.
Well, I think we're going to find out the limit of the rhetoric on states' rights, because I mean it's been a part of Republican I think theory that states should have an opportunity to define themselves how they see fit, free of as much government federal government influence as possible. So I think one of the interesting questions for me is. The state clearly has a difference of opinion with much of the country over issues like environmental regulations. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it's very powerful, right? And it goes beyond our borders. I lived in Austria from 1988 to 1992. One of the things I discovered is the Austrian Ministry of the Environment uses U.S. EPA regulations. Whatever our regulations were, they simply adopted, basically. And I think that may have changed under the EU now, but at the time, that was a very, was the way they operated. I think one of the other issues is you have the sixth largest economy in the world and its economies of scale, right? If you're the auto industry and you sell far more cars in California than anywhere else, are you going to want to have two separate assembly lines, one producing cars for California, one producing cars for the rest of the country? And that's, that's replicated across a lot of different product lines. So the state carries a tremendous amount of weight, not just its own, size of its own economic production, but also our consumption and all these other things shape I think, trends inside the United States. And the soft power element is not to be underestimated, too. I mean, Los Angeles is the center of the film and media industry in a lot of ways. This is the center of technology. I mean, so many of these major enterprises come out of California. So many of these trends come out of California, and that's not going to change.
Well, this is a question from Matt Bogosian. He says, can you assess the prospects of Chinese leadership with the state of California or otherwise in aggressively reducing GHG pollution? We'll need to avoid the worst of global warming. So it sort of dovetails on what you were talking about in terms of, our environmental regulations. And I think you're absolutely right. It'll be a question of whether or not California can continue to implement its more stringent policies as it would like to. But would anyone like to tackle this question from Matt about China and its leadership with the state of California?
Yeah, I don't know how to link it back to California any more than Bruce just has. And I think sometimes, when a state shows leadership, there's both the reason you don't want to have two assembly lines, but there's also an appeal about that leadership. They're can be a race to the top. It wouldn't be the first time that California set the trend. We're pretty used to that. Mm-hmm. So, but as for China's influence, I don't know. David, do you have a sense?
Well, I mean, I'd like to pick up on a point that I think Bruce made earlier about the importance of subnational institutions. I think California is a wonderful example of where state and local leadership on environmental issues is going to continue irrespective of what happens at the federal level. And I think what we're seeing in cities across Asia is a growing interest in green growth strategies. Beijing is going to want to clean up its act in terms of air pollution just because it's choking and people are getting sick and dying. And you're going to see innovation taking place at the urban level, at the provincial level. And I think there's a lot of scope for exchanges of experience between California cities and Chinese cities on a peer-to-peer, shared learning basis in terms of environmental issues, and I think you're going to see that as kind of a broader regional phenomenon. And in fact, I think Bruce has actually been involved in a number of efforts to try and work with urban leaders across Asia in terms of sharing their experience in terms of urban resilience and environmental cleanup. So I think that is going to continue irrespective of what happens at the Washington, D.C. federal level.
Well, this audience member asks, the Trump administration has advocated a transactional approach to international affairs, especially vis-a-vis Russia. Notions of a grand bargain have been discussed. What form, if any, would or could such a bargain take between the U.S. and China in terms of China's support for North Korea? We could solve this issue today.
I mean, right? I think as
what form could it take?
But I mean, as Gloria pointed out, in order to get any kind of progress on North Korea, we will need the Chinese. They will need to put on some real pressure, more pressure economically. From their perspective, they have to really worry about a North Korea collapsing under the weight and then suddenly having a great influx of migration from the north. So they've got good reason to not want to rush to even greater sanctions. But that bargain, I mean, if there's a bargain, China has to be part of it. Let's put it that way.
So are you saying that you're not sure if, for example, their coal sanctions are a sign of...
They may well be. They may well be. But the question is, do they go further?
And how
do
long
they go
do they
even
last?
Beyond?
And we have some
but
more.
But it's absolutely right that it has to be a three-way, at least three players in that.
Zach Hollander asks, what would a trade war with China look like? Could it be presented as America first, despite the overwhelming evidence that manufacturing has been lost to automation? And could it truly ignite a broader hot conflict or war? This is a big question, right? What does... Transactional is one way to describe Donald Trump's approach. Reciprocity is another way to describe Donald Trump's approach. What could an escalation look like in terms of Zach's question about a trade war with China? I mean, is that how concerned are you about that relationship deteriorating to that point? Anyone want to tackle Zach's question?
I think it moving to a hot war is pretty unlikely. Right, there's too much to lose. I mean, a trade war, yes, but actual military confrontation, I think, is everybody's such a great fear. What do you say to that, David?
Well, one of our experts on this America's Role project was the former foreign minister of South Korea, and he's a professor of international relations and brings a wonderful historic perspective of reminding us of the era of Smoot-Hawley and what that did to the world economy, not just the U.S. economy. And if you think about a tit-for-tat escalating set of tariffs and barriers, there is a substantial risk of really undermining the basis for global, not just U.S. Economic growth. I think it's also important to point out that an awful lot of what is being manufactured in the U.S. is being manufactured with components from China. So these are integrated supply chains. And if you start talking about a 40%, 45% tariff, that's going to translate into what people pay when they go to Walmart in terms of buying things that that Americans have been very accustomed to being able to purchase at a fairly reasonable price because of the fact that they are being imported from China and from other countries across the region. So I think cooler heads ultimately will prevail. I think there will certainly be a lot of ratcheting up of rhetoric, and there may be some symbolic gestures that are taken as a basis for, setting the table for the art of the deal. But I would be real surprised if things were allowed to spiral out of control to the point where you end up in an all-out trade war.
The U.S. federal government's retreat from a chief policing/regulating role in the world could also give the opportunity for another country entity to raise the bar in some domains. Do you think it is plausible that we will get improved global standards for environmental regulation, labor relations, data sharing, or immigration, even if the U.S. is left out? Good big question. Bruce Pickering is shaking his head no, and Gloria Duffy is nodding yes. So Bruce Pickering, let me first hear your
nodding
perspective.
Yes. Well,
or nodding
as in terms of good question.
Yeah, I can't imagine that we would disagree about this. I think as I think about it, I mean, one of the critical issues is that I don't see how you can leave the United States out. For example, it is now the world's second largest emitter of greenhouse gases, so it's no longer the first. But, you know, the issues of climate change are not going to go away. The rest of the world is clearly alarmed. And I think when you look at all these areas where the United States has been indispensable, you can't just undo that overnight. I guess you could, but the results would be absolutely catastrophic. And I think that's going to probably, reality is going to bite pretty soon. And I also think that there's kind of a bit of an unintended consequences element to this. I voted on November 8th. I got on a plane on November 9th and headed to China. When I arrived on November 10th, Xi Jinping was in Peru for the APEC summit, and front page of the South China Morning Post was a quote by him saying, basically, if the United States doesn't want to run the global system, China will be happy to do it. So is this what you all had in mind? I mean, really, that's the question I would ask. And I think it reflects, again, our West Coast, but also probably the East Coast orientation versus the rest of the country. And I think the problem is if you're living in a zip code that has high opioid use, you've got major unemployment, it's hard to see how these international agreements affect you. It just sort of looks like a world in which, you know, you've been left behind. But I think the problem is you'll learn real fast when your Walmart prices start going up 30% or 40% and you suddenly you're already having a problem making ends meet. You want to have a trade war with the Chinese, you'll see your ends, you know, really not meeting at that point. So, it's been proven consistently time and again that these trade wars lead to international tensions, which frequently lead to conflict, and they make everybody poorer.
Likely is it, do you think, David Arnold, that, you know, these nations did come together to hammer out the Trans-Pacific Partnership, right? I don't think you could revive it in its exact same form without the United States as part of it. But with the linkages that were created through that process, could some other...
Interesting because I think there is now a growing discussion around some sort of middle power coalition in the Asia-Pacific region with, you know, Australia, Korea, I don't want to characterize them as middle powers, Japan, India, great powers of historic importance. But there is this sense that if the U.S. is not going to be around, we may have to do more of this on our own. And in some respects, you know, there's a recognition that it was kind of convenient to be able to, you know, either blame the U.S. for whatever it did or blame it for whatever it didn't do. And now there's at least a growing discussion about a greater need for self-reliance and greater need for regional cooperation between and among neighboring countries and countries that have a shared interest in the region. So I think you may see more of that. And there is, talk of the fact that just because the U.S. doesn't go forward with TPP, there are other countries that are signatories that have ratified TPP and that ought to continue and carry on and see if the U.S. later on decides to come along. I think there are definite advantages to not falling into a lower common denominator of the Chinese-led RCEP, which is the kind of alternative trade regime that people are talking about if in fact, TPP is not going to be the gold standard that it was promised to be. I think there is some possibility of the middle power countries actually starting to come together in a little bit more of a coalition.
What are you watching for most in terms of the way this administration, the Trump administration, maneuvers around Asia as a sign for how it may approach the region? What is something that you're really watching for in terms of this administration's behavior? Bruce Pickering, do you want to pick that off first?
That's a tough question. I think it will be interesting. I mean, the first thing that happened, as soon as Trump was inaugurated was, trips to Asia by senior, and to Europe, actually, by senior administration officials, I think to reassure the allies. So I think one of the critical questions is going to be, you've had alliances with South Korea and Japan that have really anchored our presence in Asia and, of course, NATO and Europe. I think the question that the most fundamental issue to my mind really is security at this point because, I don't think anybody wants the Chinese or the South Koreans to have nuclear weapons, least of all the South Koreans or the Japanese. I think the sense is that the last, it's not a good thing. NATO provides something in Europe that doesn't exist in Asia, which is an overarching security umbrella that ties the Germans and the French historical rivals, the British and the Germans historical rivals together. That doesn't exist in Asia. So the United States in some ways fulfills that role by, the security guarantee that it provides to South Korea and to Japan. And it's in return, I think Asia gets a lot of peace. If you somehow alter the relationship, I think that could be very dangerous because you create an opportunity for those historical tensions. I mean, South Korea and Japan are still having major disagreements over the presentation of the issues of the comfort women. That's not going to go away. It's actually a manifestation of something that I think a lot greater. There are some real fundamental tensions in all these places. And then you've got a really unstable regime in North Korea that could potentially destabilize the entire region. So you really, I think that to me is the critical question right there.
How the administration responds
to its, does it reassure our allies? I mean, the problem is you've got the president, certainly when he was president-elect when he was candidate, making comments about, the viability of these security relationships across the whole world. Which are we looking at here? Are we looking at a United States that respects its alliances, or are we looking at a United States that is going to go so far inward that we're, these alliances are going to rupture?
Right. He complained about, Japan and Korea not paying its fair share for defenses, and now he and Shinzo Abe seem to be best friends, but how long is that going to last?
Well, and if you're Estonia, for example, and you're a recent, addition to NATO, I mean, you're a little worried about the fact that country's not very old. It's about 25, 30 years old. I mean, it's a country that really, really wants NATO to be something. So I think you have to be, and words matter. I mean, that's the problem. I mean, you can't just unsay them, and I think that's a real issue.
David Arnold, you wanted to jump in here.
I think one thing that I would watch for, and particularly from a South Asia perspective, is what does the U.S. do about Afghanistan? And where does the Trump administration come out in terms of maintaining a continued military and security commitment there and engaging in the hard work of development, reconstruction, peace building in a country where we have made major investment both in terms of treasure and in terms of the lives of our troops. And Afghanistan has been kind of notably absent, both in terms of policy pronouncements from the administration, as well as in the election campaign. There was really very little discussion or debate about, you know, where does the U.S. go in terms of its commitments in Afghanistan, and yet people are watching very closely, particularly in South Asia, to see what direction the U.S. takes. We've seen this movie before of pulling out and seeing, you know, the security situation change radically for the worse. How long do you keep, you know, 8,500 troops there? Do you increase the number of troops? Do you try and get to the zero option? I think those are questions that people are going to be watching very, very closely to see what the administration's commitment is.
Gloria Duffy.
So,
what are you watching?
To be, for a country like the United States, to be a leader on the international stage, we have to have coherent policies. You have to be able to communicate what you're doing and why you're doing it. Who are our friends? Who are our enemies? What is our policy towards on the major global problems, on security issues, and so on? I remember way back to the Nixon administration. Richard Nixon used to issue a foreign policy statement every year. It was written by Henry Kissinger, I believe, and it was very coherent. It sort of took a global look. What about nonproliferation? What's our policy towards China? What's our policy towards the Soviet Union? Arms control, et cetera. Global trade. And you could sort of look at that and see where is this administration going? Where's the United States going in terms of its global leadership role? The last bomb thrower president we had was Ronald Reagan, where he started his administration with some very different policy directions and statements. You know, the evil empire, as opposed to detente and collaboration with the Soviet Union wherever we could. He essentially threw out a bunch of new directions. But he had George Shultz there, who then turned those into policies that others could understand and that were somewhat collaborative. And they took some new directions, but they were coherent. So what I look for and what I don't see is I see the new directions and new statements on individual issues or individual countries, I don't see any coherence or any ability to communicate coherently in a way that would demonstrate our leadership and that there's a thoughtful approach here to the other countries in the region. So what I look for is the development of some type of more maturity in the execution of the policy that can take a president's broad statements, like George Shultz did in his wise way, and turn them into policies that make sense.
Yeah, it gets back to my earlier question about who is really driving this, and are the adults Rex Tillerson, James Mattis, in your view, right? I mean, can they do that for this particular
Well, there particular is no person? Emerging leader of experience in the foreign policy field generally, emerging yet, that I can see.
Jane Wales, what are you?
I think that's right. I mean, I think that neither Secretary Mattis or Secretary Tillerson has the kind of freedom to maneuver that you would hope for, or the clear guidance. Right? There's an inconsistent guidance coming out of the White House, and we may get one guidance, but then there's a tweet that sends you in a different direction. And so, I do think part of it is having a well-staffed government that has some, has a role other than the kind of defending the latest tweet, but instead developing the policies around a goal that the president puts forth. And we're not seeing that. I mean, I think General Mattis is a very able guy. I don't know Rex Tillerson, but I'm sure he is as well. These are very experienced managers. They're people who know how to translate a concept, an idea, a goal into a set of steps. But I don't see them having the freedom to do that right now.
And in terms of signifiers in this administration, in terms of their approach to Asia, what you're watching for next?
Well, I'm can't help but, I mean, I think there's a very good point to raise Afghanistan, and I can't help but think that the question of, you know, Kim is trying to call the question with North Korea. He's trying to test a guy who is very easily goaded, right? And so how he reacts to this, whether President Trump understands that here's an instance where you can't go it alone, whether he understands that here's an instance where military responses can't be the only tool in your toolbox and is probably the least useful tool you'd have. So it would take away some pretty fundamental, if you look at what his gut reactions is to situations like this, it tends to be to carry and use a big stick or threaten a big stick, and to be very uncooperative with friends and allies, and very unclear as to the real objectives.
How close do you think North Korea is to actually having the capability of, you know, a long-range missile that could hit the United States?
Well, that might be 3 years or 4 years or something like that. I don't know, but the question is, it's already way too close.
Yeah, I've heard anywhere estimates of two to four. I mean, it depends on who you're talking to.
And you don't wait until a nuclear warhead falls on you, right? And in fact, that's what extended deterrence is, what the umbrella is, that we would protect South Korea and Japan in that way, and they are both within range. So there, if you're serious about the nuclear umbrella, you're serious about there being no difference between an attack on Japan and an attack on San Francisco.
So my last question, which is there anything in this, in the maneuvering, in the approach, that you could tell us through a glass half full approach, right? Glass half full perspective on this particular administration in terms of its dealings with this region. Bruce, I'm not sure you're the first to answer this question, because I can tell you you're feeling pretty concerned about
well, that. Yeah. I mean, I guess the good news is the glass, if you're looking at glass half full, the bar's kind of low, so you don't have to, the expectations are not there. And if the concerns are there, so it does actually, oddly enough, give you a bit more latitude to do something and creative and different. So that's to me is the possible best case scenario. But as somebody who has worked in the foreign policy machinery and things, the thing that strikes me is that government and business are completely different, and there's a reason for that. I mean, government favors, you know, it's long term, it's regulation, it's kind of a stable playing field. And what people want out of government, I think, is that it essentially, stays out of the way, but provides kind of a basis that everything can be sort of, measured against. I think if you find government behaving like a business, which is going after big opportunities, looking at kind of a one law, you know, I win, you lose, it becomes very disruptive very fast. And I think, you know, the possibilities are endless, and some of them could be fantastic. I mean, maybe, you know, Donald Trump, you know, basically hits the equivalent of a royal flush, to use the poker analogy. But maybe he busts, too, in which case, you know, that's bad.
Gloria Duffy.
I do see a few areas where the glass is at least half full. So I don't have a problem with the Trump administration sending the USS Carl Vinson to the South China Sea. Free access to the seas, standing in the way of China's policies of creating islands and otherwise domesticating the South China Sea, I think that's a good thing. And I think our military power, demonstrating our military power there, short of any military clashes, is a very good thing. There are some intractable problems that we've been working at for many years that we haven't made a lot of progress on. Shaking things up isn't necessarily a bad idea because no new ideas have come up. Now, I would say North Korea is maybe one of those problems. I'm not sure anything we're doing right now constitutes productive shaking up, but that's one that hasn't been going in a good direction, no matter what policies we've adopted. So again, on principle, shaking things up is not bad. If you have then a team that can come in and say, okay, now we've shaken things up, here's a new direction to policy, let's try to make this work, and can mobilize friends and allies and so on to do that. There are some areas in the, such as trade and climate change, where it is more of an institutional process where we've been making progress step by step, where I think shaking things up is a bad thing. So the glass is definitely much less than half full there.
And I think that the sort of the crazy man theory sometimes really works. But Gloria Duffy noted at the very beginning that Nixon did things like this. Nixon very consciously wanted to make sure that adversaries didn't know what he would do, so they would show their hand in part, but so they would believe anything is possible, that the U.S. wasn't constrained, and so there could be some really negative consequences to crossing the U.S. So the crazy man theory, you know, can work so long as you know where you want it to end up. The crazy man can't be crazy, right? He needs to know where he's heading, and that's where we're less clear. We don't actually know. I mean, I think I certainly don't know, and that isn't to say he doesn't know. It just I don't know what it is. I think on the one thing to think about, even though we're all globally focused in this room, is that our strength as a country is trust. It's the fact that we trust in our institutions, we trust in the processes, we trust in one another. And that's what makes a liberal democracy work. And a democracy, if we're turning on each other, if we don't trust each other, if we're pointing our fingers at each other, there's a very high risk that we'll sort of lose social cohesion, we'll lose what makes this country truly great. And so if I were offering advice, I mean, in a way, it's kind of good that Donald Trump has early on found himself up against that, finding himself sort of pointing fingers and reducing trust. And so my hope is that early on, that glass will become half full, that he'll understand that he needs a robust, engaged, dynamic, cohesive, and trusting society behind it.
David Arnold.
A couple of things. One, I was just in India, and if there is a bright spot in terms of U.S.-Asia relations right now, I think it is the U.S.-India relationship, where there has been steady progress, and there are expectations that progress will continue, and that the relationship, the economic relationship, the increased military cooperation will continue. So there is at least one glass half full story that I can report on. I think the other thing that I would regard as half full, and people in the region commented and talked about it, was, and I alluded to this earlier, the sense that it was too easy in some ways for the Asians to essentially let the U.S. do it. And I think there is now a growing recognition that Asia is at a point where it is more dynamic, more prosperous, has more capability and capacity to do things on its own than it has had in the past, can be a bit more self-reliant. Call it burden sharing, call it what you will, but I think there is an opportunity here as the U.S. starts to define more clearly the extent to which it's going to be engaged and the particular form that engagement will take for Asian countries to step forward and to take on additional responsibility and show new initiatives on their own. And I think that's, on the whole, a good and positive thing in terms of the maturity of U.S.-Asia relations going forward.
Well, there are a lot of unknowns, but I think we've been able to tackle at least what some of the key issues are, what's at stake, and maybe even some areas of hope. David Arnold, president of the Asia Foundation, Jane Whale, CEO of World Affairs and Global Philanthropy Forum, and vice president of the Aspen Institute, Bruce Pickering of the Asia Society, and Gloria Duffy, president and CEO of the Commonwealth Club of California. Thanks, all of you, for sharing your insights.
Thank you.